Part 2. From rumors to a royal commission. The truth comes out. 2013 to 2020. Truth or Dare? The Lawyer X Story Breaks. 2013 to 2014. Anthony Dowsley's search for the truth begins with a question of sex. Did a high-ranking police officer once have an affair with a barrister who represented some of the biggest criminals during Melbourne's gangland war? Did they have a love child? Dowsley much prefers investigating murders and mysteries. His usual job is to expose secrets, evil acts, and the abuses of power, known in journalism as hard news. He once tracked down a notorious pedophile to a cottage near Melbourne's Flemington Racecourse in 2005. It triggered the man's removal from the suburbs. Victoria's worst pedophiles released from prison were subsequently grouped with provisional liberty within the grounds of Ararat Prison. Dowsley's 2006 anniversary story about a cold case murder victim, Elizabeth Membry, fed fresh police inquiries and murder charges after the case had stagnated since 1994. Crime reporters like Dowsley trawl the sumps of depravity, which is why many veterans don't trust much in human nature. As one of them cynically put it once, their role is to harvest grief. Dowsley has been a crime reporter for a decade, but he isn't as jaded as some. He is obsessive, as the successful ones must be, and dogged about getting at the truth. But he is always glad to set aside the bandits and monsters to discuss Midnight Oil or the Western Bulldogs AFL Club. He is ambivalent about the Gobbo love child claims. Salacious gossip gushes out of Victoria Police headquarters like the runoff from an abattoir. This Gobbo rumour, initially involving former Assistant Commissioner Jeff Pope, commands the usual sniggering from police when it's recounted to Dowsley in the pub. Yet it is not the claim itself, but what it hints of that makes it the unlikely starting point for Dowsley's uncovering of the biggest legal scandal in modern Australia. Ironically, the rumour was unwittingly started 2 years earlier by Nicola Gobbo herself. She has always blamed police leaks for the exposure of her informing, but who knows how it would have been revealed if Gobbo, in seeking to sting a man from her past, had not stung herself as well. In October 2011, she gave a confidential police interview to Task Force driver detectives investigating the death of Carl Williams, including Detective Senior Sergeant Boris Buick. It's unclear whether she was asked for or volunteered the information. Call it boastfulness or revenge, Gobbo casually lobbed a grenade at a senior police officer who had rejected her as both an informer and, he says, a potential partner way back in 2000. Assistant Commissioner Jeff Pope, in his second stint at Victoria Police, sat on the Task Force Driver Steering Committee, responsible for the executive oversight of the investigation. He'd also been on the steering committee of PETRA before that task force was disbanded in August 2010. "I'll tell you something, just a skerrick of information that you'll laugh at," Gobbo told the detectives. "Do you know who the assistant commissioner was, who I only found out after the event, who was overseeing my handling when I was being looked after by PETRA? Was Jeff Pope for a while, wasn't it?" When Buick said yes, she went on, "Would you think it was appropriate if I had a sexual relationship with you that you looked after that committee? How's that for inaudible for you? Have a look at Boris's face. I wish I could take a photo of that." She explained that somebody told me that Jeff Pope was assistant commissioner in charge of the steering committee, and I thought, "Jeff Pope? That sounds familiar. Jeff Pope. Where do I know that name from?" Then I saw him on TV and I said to my sister, "Oh my God, I just think it's hilarious, she commented. Isn't that inappropriate? Can you imagine the complaint I could make about that? I bet you he hasn't declared it. The fallout was almost immediate. Pope stepped down from the Driver Task Force Steering Committee, pending an investigation, never to return to the role. He vehemently denied any improper relationship with Gobbo, and even signed an affidavit to make his point. Yet he was hopelessly mired. There was no scope to prove or disprove Gobbo's claim. He was condemned in 2013 in the Court of Rumours and Nastiness on the say-so of a professional liar. The man who had wanted to be Chief Commissioner left abruptly in 2013. Rumour has it, 10 minutes after a fireside chat with Deputy Commissioner Graham Ashton. Some people wanted to believe the gossip, whether it was true or not. Pope had a neurological disorder that affected his stride, leaving him open to unkind comparisons with the Thunderbirds. He had just been diagnosed with bladder cancer, and now he was lugged with the Gobbo claims. He had returned to Victoria Police a couple of years earlier, after a stretch with the Federal Police, to head up the Covert Services Division, and discovered that very senior jobs demand very tough decisions. In 2012, he had been asked to conduct a review of the division, including Gobbo's former handlers at the Source Development Unit, SDU. Drawing heavily on former Chief Commissioner Neil Comrie's report, Pope recommended the closure of the SDU in January 2013. Pope's review found that Comrie had highlighted poor work practices of the SDU that had significant ramifications. Here was Pope's kicker. The structure of the SDU should not be sustained, and whilst it continues to exist, it will only be a matter of time before the unit unduly exposes a human source, or Victoria Police, to significant risk which cannot be mitigated. SDU members to this day are aghast at the decision to close the unit down, particularly given they were not consulted first. The SDU's head, Sandy White, blames personal animosities for the decision. His immediate boss was a bully, and a boss higher up the chain dismissed White as a Svengali. White believes his superiors were wrong to disband a first-rate human source unit. To be told that any document concerning source matters with my name on it is toxic is beyond comprehension, he told a police colleague in 2014. This could only be the result of a campaign to destroy my reputation. When detectives feed Dowsley crumbs of gossip at the Palmerston Hotel that Christmas drinks night in 2013, Dowsley glimpses a story behind the story, about a defence barrister who is not as she appears. In 2009, before Gobbo's role as a witness against Dale was made public, Dowsley overheard chatter in a St Kilda pizzeria about her secret cosiness with police. She's worth looking at, he thought at the time. That night in 2013, he goes home at about 12:30 a.m. and types some notes on his iPhone to remind himself of what he's just heard. Many journalists do this after drinks with contacts. Some go into the toilets to leave themselves slurred voicemails, recording details that might otherwise be lost in an alcoholic haze. Dowsley is reciting scuttlebutt, not facts, based on chats with detectives who have had no direct involvement with Gobbo. He writes, "Was she used as a human source to gain intelligence from her clients? Unit was shut down and its informers discharged. Pope suddenly moved from the job. Paid out $2 million to Gobbo. Major cover-up?" This riot of rumours is what Dowsley begins exploring the next morning. The curious case of the police, a dodgy defence barrister, and a child of unclear paternity. Gobbo is not the only chameleon in this story. Dowsley's knack is shifting gear without giving the appearance of any change at all. His faded T-shirts and unassuming manner provide cover for his astuteness. He sets out to prove his suspicion that Gobbo is a human source, but he has to be cautious. Linking Gobbo to informing could trigger threats to her life, as well as Victoria Police efforts to kill his story before it is published. Solicitor Rod Starry echoes Dowsley's suspicions. He contextualizes some of the unseen machinations of the Hodson deaths. He tells Dowsley he took over Hodson's case from Gobbo after Hodson was charged in December 2003, though by April 2004, Gobbo had taken back her client from Starry. For Starry, her removal as a witness from the ACC trial against Paul Dale has provoked a recurring thought. What does Nicola Gobbo have over Victoria Police? Dowsley delves into the paperwork of her 2010 civil suit, in which she claimed $20 million. Such an exorbitant price tag, just for giving evidence, didn't make much sense. Someone tells Dowsley of the tangled backstory behind the Gobbo settlement. Someone else tells Dowsley the story of the stings that brought down the Mokbel Empire from April 2006. It is an incomplete account about a controlled delivery of fake drugs to Milad Mokbel. Gobbo was improperly involved, Dowsley is told, but he learns scant details of her betrayals. In the new year, Dowsley contacts one or two investigators who know Gobbo well. They are not chatty. If they're not across the breadth of her informer status, they are aware of her constant presence at police functions. Others say it's odd to see a defence barrister, as opposed to a defence solicitor, in police stations. And Gobbo always seemed to materialise at police stations. Dowsley is loaded with speculations, but he needs hard facts. He doesn't know what to believe. The notion of a double-dealing lawyer holds significant risks, primarily to her welfare. When Dowsley hints of it to trusted contacts, he is met with open-mouthed disbelief. The fullest account of Dowsley's investigation cannot be recounted without breaching ethical imperatives to protect sources. By 2014, hundreds of people know about Gobbo's informing, within both policing and legal circles. Most know no more than snippets of the grander script. Some of the sources who share secrets with Dowsley are motivated by their disgust at Victoria Police's disregard for the justice system. Gobbo's use conflicts with the notions of fairness upon which they built their careers. Dowsley keeps collecting the hints, like a sparrow pecking at crumbs, trying to form a fuller picture. Suspicions are an occupational hazard of investigative journalism. It's an obsessive's trade, built on tips and conspiracy theories, often furnished by malcontents who mangle facts for their own ends. In March 2014, Dowsley meets with one particular source who knows a few things from a long time ago, when Gobbo first started informing to police. Pardon? Has Dowsley heard right? He's hunched in a city coffee shop, his faded black canvas bag at his feet, taking no notes, lest the subject take fright and clam up. Is this the confirmation he's been seeking? The damning evidence that has shimmered just out of reach? This source seems keen to talk. Dowsley asks another question. How did it start? It was the late 1990s. Gobbo met a certain drug squad officer over coffee, the subject replied. Later evidence will suggest this officer was Senior Sergeant Wayne Strawhorn. Gobbo's motivation was neither betrayal nor greed, he says. She came eager to help. She said she couldn't look in the mirror when she defended such scumbags. The source knows of the controversy over Gobbo's role within police command during her period as an informer. Some senior officers feared her safety was being unreasonably jeopardized, particularly after she was deregistered as an informer to be a witness against Paul Dale. Dowsley farewells the source, then frantically scribbles down everything he can recall of the chat. He feels overwhelmed by the possibilities. Dating her informing to the late 1990s suggests that she was an informer for a very long time. The notion still seems absurd to Dowsley. He has trawled newspaper clippings, seen Gobbo pictured with Mock Bell and Rob Carum. Did she betray them? Dowsley now knows that Gobbo was suspected of being an accessory in the Hodson murders. But then Senior Brass stepped in and abruptly shut down the Petra task force. Dowsley can't work out why, in 2014, she is yet to be held to account for her inexplicable choices in the lead-up to the double homicide. Factoring in his growing belief that Gobbo was a police informer, he wonders if the Hodson investigation was hobbled for all the wrong reasons. He has a moment of truth exchange in February 2014 when he puts his Gobbo speculations to someone who is well placed to know. That person says nothing, but gives him a thumbs up. It is enough to tweak Dowsley's antenna. He is closing in on the full picture. He rings Gobbo out of the blue in mid-March 2014. Now isn't the time to put allegations to her about informing. That's for the last minute, for when he is certain of the facts and has gathered enough material to publish a story. Instead, he asks about Pope and the apparent relationship many years earlier. Gobbo says it happened. Pope has denied sleeping with Gobbo. Dowsley takes stock. He collates his notes to see what he knows and what he does not. Some of his conclusions stem from what people will not talk about. Omissions such as, I can't say, or no comment, almost count for as much as admissions. He has cross-referenced the dates. Gobbo was informing to police when Tony Mockbell and Rob Carum were her clients. It seems logical that she improperly helped police convict them. Dowsley's email to himself on the 17th of March has some fresh points. The endangerment to her life. The IVF baby. Remained a human source with one contact point, which she does not like. Still practicing. Her addiction to underworld and men. He keeps sniffing. In the final weeks of March 2014, Dowsley gets his cold, hard proof. From an unlikely place, he gets Gobbo's informer number, 3838, and the number of internal information reports she has generated. Dowsley is told there are more than 5,000. Someone tells him that Gobbo gave police the bill of lading that fingered the Tomato Tins Ecstasy Syndicate. He is across the police suspicions that Gobbo passed on Terry Hodson's informer history contained in the blue file to the underworld. If Gobbo's informing is the centerpiece of his investigation, it also pales as only one aspect in Gobbo's bigger career of double dealing. 2 months after his boozy night at the pub, Dowsley feels he finally has enough for an article. The latest revelations serve as a trigger. He feels he cannot sit on the story, lest another inquiring journalist should stumble across the same information. Dowsley has fashioned a narrative loaded with secrets, deceptions, and speculations. This story has massive implications, some that not even Dowsley can foresee at this point. But he is canny enough to recognize that the justice system has been undermined, and prisoners could be freed. His hope of uncovering an informer scandal has exploded into something far bigger, involving secrets about the Hodsons and other gangland murders, as well as drug syndicates and the Calabrian Mafia. He believes the secrets probably warrant a royal commission. It's Sunday morning. Dowsley rings his editor, Damon Johnston, who is at the park with his daughter. Johnston goes quiet at the mention of Gobbo's name. The Sunday Herald Sun had settled a defamation action brought by her in 2011 after the paper published details of her 1993 drug arrest and conviction. Hers was a bold play, given she was unlikely to have taken the stand if the newspaper had contested the claim. Johnston was the editor of the Sunday Herald Sun at the time. He was ass-kicked for the payout to her. But Dowsley starts talking, and Johnston is mesmerized. Dowsley's information not only rewrites the entire history of the gangland war, but could also trigger the release of dozens of serious criminals. He is describing a wholesale corruption of the Victorian justice system. "Are you 100% on what you've told me?" Johnston asks.
Yeah, I am."
Johnston wants to publish the story tomorrow. Like Dowsley, he fears being scooped by a rival newspaper. Dowsley inwardly groans. He'll have to miss this afternoon's Western Bulldogs game to file the story. Then Johnston asks the critical question. "Should we name her?" The answer will have huge ramifications over the next 5 years. The newspaper could name Gobbo, which would strengthen the story considerably, but Johnston is mindful of the possible consequences for Gobbo's safety. He does not want a story about the secret abuse of power hijacked by a debate about editorial recklessness. Gobbo's identity as an informer, once out, cannot be retrieved. He goes with prudence, no name. He considers aliases for Gobbo. The Lawyer X label, which will become so ubiquitous, is coined on the spot while his daughter Phoebe directs Johnston to keep pushing her swing. Gobbo herself does not know how many details Dowsley has uncovered until he takes a deep breath and rings her later that same afternoon. It's never easy to tell someone that you're about to upend their life. Fears for Gobbo's safety have haunted Dowsley. What news organization takes steps that could inspire the murder of a mother? How compelling is the public interest if its pursuit ends in a killing? But when Dowsley tells her she's about to become front-page news, Gobbo isn't belligerent. She does not plead. Instead, she feigns ignorance. She is neither talkative nor rude. She avoids denials. The professional liar, whose career has been preserved by mistruths and cover-ups, is once again protecting herself from a bullet. She responds to the informer claim as if she's hearing foreign news. She knows things about police tactics, she counters, but deflects direct questions about police informing. She gets off the phone with Dowsley and immediately calls the police. Over the coming hours, Victoria Police will try to kill Dowsley's story. The police are mandated to hide Gobbo's identity as an informer, and a newspaper journalist is poised to tell the world. At this stage, there is little of the hype that Gobbo's story will generate later. Only a few people within the Herald Sun know the Lawyer X story is coming. Unlike most exclusives, it's not treated as the biggest story of the day. Dowsley's story is page one, but only a strip, not the splash or main story. Published on Monday, the 31st of March, 2014, Lawyer, a secret police informer, is a restrained collection of confirmed facts. A prominent underworld lawyer was recruited by Victoria Police to inform on criminal figures running Melbourne's drug trade for more than a decade. The controversial move to list the lawyer, whom the Herald Sun has chosen to name only as Lawyer X, as a registered informer, gave the force unprecedented access to information on some of Australia's biggest drug barons and hitmen, including alleged corrupt police and others involved in Melbourne's gangland war. The force's biggest secret in turning a high-profile criminal lawyer into an informer brings into question police ethics in cultivating human sources, which went spectacularly wrong after the informer became a witness in one of Australia's biggest criminal investigations. The article goes on to mention, in veiled terms, Gobbo's implication in the Hodson case before Task Force Petra was suddenly shut down. and the police command email that excused her from giving evidence at Paul Dale's lying trial in 2011. If such sources of information ever existed in the fight against the New York Mafia or the Chicago mob, they were never exposed. This is a Melbourne exclusive and a world first. These 504 words will shape years of courtroom wrangling, give prisoners hope of early release, and drive a police force to extreme lengths to hide its secret abuse of power. Yet for Dowsley, the showtime moment after months of work is tinged with disappointment. His accumulated dossier of explosive truths has been stripped back to abstractions. The revelations raise more questions than answers. To this day, he brings up the fact that his lawyer X story was trumped by a page one report about tenants trashing public housing. The first edition of the Herald Sun goes to print at 8 p.m. Dowsley is at the pub with Chris Tinkler, the paper's deputy editor, when a call comes through a few minutes before 8. Herein lies Dowsley's next disappointment. The call is from Police Assistant Media Director Charlie Morton. Dowsley rang Morton while going to work on the tram earlier that day. Concerned about Gobbo's safety, Dowsley felt he should advise Morton that the story was about to be published. Now, Morton asks to see the story, by this time moments from being published. Tinkler and Dowsley don't have to show him, but acquiesce as a courtesy. They soon regret their choice, and to this day, each blames the other for making it. The next call, within the hour, is from Johnston, ringing from his kitchen. He tells Dowsley and Tinkler that a posse of police and lawyers has raced to the Supreme Court to prevent the story from being published. The first edition, a small print run that goes to regional Victoria, has already been printed. In events lifted from a black-and-white newsroom movie, the police are trying to stop the presses before the Lawyer X story is published in the second and third editions, which comprise the overwhelming majority of newspapers printed. Tinkler turns a shade of puce, while Dowsley races from the pub back to the office. He and his editors are captive to legal machinations. Lives are at risk. Lawyers for the police argue. In the end, the arguments are not put to a judge, as they will be in coming days, weeks, and years. Instead, on this first night, police lawyers and the Herald Sun's lawyer, John Paul Cashin, reach an agreement outside the courtroom. About half a dozen facts, deemed to tend to identify Gobbo, are removed from the story published in later editions. The following morning, Tuesday the 1st of April, is telling. Victoria Police, like any large organisation, usually rush media outlets to denounce a story when it's wrong. But the force isn't saying anything in public about Lawyer X. Dowsley thinks he knows why. A well-placed source tells him that some police officers have broken the law by lying in court to protect Gobbo's identity. Victoria Police have a lot to hide. Dowsley's tale is out. Just. Yet the Herald Sun can't tell you who Nicola Gobbo is, why she became an informer, or how the justice system was corrupted by her use. The newspaper can't even state her gender. Legal circles are full of chatter over the story. The fact seems so unlikely and so repugnant to any decent lawyer. Johnston wants to apply pressure and keep running the Lawyer X story day after day. He uses the facts extracted under the temporary agreement between police lawyers and Cashin from the day one story and applies them to the day two story about the abrupt end of the Petra Task Force investigation into the Hodson killings. A police task force into multiple murders was shut down to protect a high-profile lawyer used as an informer. Lawyer X, who the Herald Sun revealed yesterday was recruited to inform on senior crime figures for years, also pocketed a multi-million dollar payout to keep silent and as compensation as the relationship unraveled. Johnston also publishes a Herald Sun editorial that goes straight to the point. Extraordinary events over the past 48 hours have raised such deeply concerning questions over the integrity of Victoria Police that the Herald Sun believes Premier Dennis Napthine has no alternative but to order a royal commission. Johnston will admit later that he should have acted differently on day three. Darsley's cracking story has grown from a front-page strip to a front-page splash. But before publishing this third story, Johnston wants questions put to Victoria Police. The questions are pointed, name Gobbo, and are sent with a message that the Herald Sun intends to publish them in the next day's paper. Police receive the emailed request for answers from the Herald Sun late on the afternoon of the 1st of April. Then dash to the Supreme Court again. They use the questions to argue in court that the story must be suppressed because Gobbo is endangered by the Herald Sun's intimate understanding of life and death information. The judge agrees. The police action stops the Herald Sun presses. At about 8:20 p.m., Johnston has to find a new story for the front page. Inspiration under deadline pressure is a daily journalist's lot. That's how Johnston's replacement, Fight for Truth front page, is forged. Legal threats may cost him sleep, but they will not dissuade him from the cause. Designers craft a striking image featuring white print on a black background. Johnston is sending a message. The Herald Sun was last night silenced from publishing details on Lawyer X, which it believes is of extreme public interest. Victoria Police took the extraordinary action of seeking a Supreme Court injunction at 7:30 p.m., preventing the newspaper from publishing any information about Lawyer X, whom the Herald Sun had no intention of naming or identifying. As the hearing commenced, the Herald Sun was ordered by the judge to stop its presses. Editor Damon Johnston said that Victorians deserve to know the full truth. Legal battle lines are drawn, and it's clear now that Victoria Police have botched their choice of playing field. By trying to bury the story, they've plonked a cover-up on top of a scandal. They think they've done enough. Deputy Commissioner Graham Ashton exchanges emails with Morton, who believes that Cardinal George Pell's imminent appearance at the Royal Commission into Institutional Responses to Child Sexual Abuse will smother the Lawyer X coverage. Dowsley has used all his best ammo already, I think, Morton writes. None of the other journos have got anything different or are prepared to use it. The Pell stuff is coming tomorrow and will knock this way off the front page. Unless there are some serious appeals from convicted crims, which might get up as a result of this, then I can't see this continuing with the same level of profile. There will be more, but I suspect we can weather it. The Gobbo sagas would be long gone by now if Victoria Police had offered a mea culpa response in 2014. Instead of seeking to dictate what truths the Herald Sun could and couldn't publish, a police plea for understanding, lathered with contrition, would have limited the story's longevity. Instead, Ashton avoids his regular commitment to appear on the radio show of 3AW's Neil Mitchell, who has backed Dowsley's report with thundering criticism of the police. The Victorian Government Solicitor's Office issues a threat against all media. Do not publish information that tends to identify Lawyer X, or the Chief Commissioner of Police might legally prohibit your organisation from doing so. Herald Sun lawyer John Paul Cashin issues legal instructions on the 4th of April for reporting on Lawyer X. It's Friday, and the newspaper is legally restricted from publishing most of the details it reported only on Monday. Lawyer X can no longer be called a police informer. Her associates cannot be named, as Tony Mockbell and Carl Williams were in Dowsley's 1st of April story. Asked by the press about the Lawyer X story on the 7th of April, Chief Commissioner Ken Lay says, "I'm not in a position to make any comment about that at all, and I don't propose to make any comment about the alleged payment or any matters around Lawyer X. Let me just say at this stage, I am not prepared to say anything at all about this matter." Victoria Police also try to withhold information from the Office of Public Prosecutions, OPP. Senior Police and the head of Victoria Police's legal services, Finn McRae, meet with the Director of Public Prosecutions, John Champion, the day after Dowsley's first story. Meeting notes taken by the OPP's Bruce Gardner recorded the discussion. McRae says it is unclear whether Gobbo provided information about her own clients, then alludes to 18 instances, information reports, in which NG, Gobbo, may have given information to Victoria Police, re her clients. Meetings between the OPP and Police Command about Gobbo's relationship with police in fact began almost 2 years ago. As early as September 2012, according to Gardner's notes, McRae told the DPP that there may be a suggestion that NG was providing information to VicPol, Victoria Police, about persons she then professionally represented, including T. Mockbell. By then, former Police Commissioner Neil Comrie had completed his scathing report about Gobbo's use by police. But the force did not hand over the Comrie review to the DPP. Not then in 2012, even as Mockbell's legal fights meandered through the courts, and not now in 2014. The obvious conclusion is that Victoria Police are covering up the cover-up. Someone close to the April 2014 meeting offers Dowsley and Carlyon a sceptical tone about police priorities. If a teenager summed up the high-level meeting via text, it would read, "OPP, WTF, Victoria Police, LOL." Meanwhile, the mystery of Lawyer X's identity fuels speculations. Observers from afar think Lawyer X is the better-known female gangland lawyer, Zara Gard Wilson. As Victoria Police have failed to grasp, cover-ups are often just as intriguing as the misdeeds they seek to hide. On the day Dowsley's second article is published, he speaks to Gobbo again on the phone. Again, she expresses no hostility. They find common ground. Both of them are seeking information from the other. Gobbo doesn't address Dowsley's specific questions. He hopes but does not expect that she might admit to broader aspects of her informing. But she doesn't dismiss them either. "It's not about me, it's about VicPol," she says. She thinks some senior Victorian police will be very worried. Dowsley asks her why she thinks the Petra Task Force was closed down several days after Police Command issued an edict to investigators not to interview her. If they'd tried to interview her, she says, "I might retaliate." Dowsley asks how she is faring. Gobbo spouts wisdom. "You cannot control things you cannot control." Yet Gobbo suffers as much as she ever has in the days after Dowsley's exclusive story. The death threats have started again. If Gobbo is the centre of attention, as she has often wanted to be, she is almost powerless to steer events. Her secret is leaching into public view, and she is reliant on a police force she does not trust to stop the leaks. She has progressed well since her 2010 civil case against police, even if she has spent a fortune rebuilding. Her health is much better, and she has a 6-month-old daughter. Dowsley's story has destroyed all that. Now she is angry again. After years of allowing her to run her own life, police once again swarm to protect her. They offer her protection within 48 hours of the first Lawyer X story, under the same terms she previously rejected. She and her child will need to be swiftly moved to another location, and she will cease contact with all family and friends, permanently. Gobbo says no. She will not give up the treatment of her doctors. Anyway, she says, police protection is neither safe nor appropriate. She does not trust Victoria Police to keep the confidentiality of any agreement. Victoria Police will spend untold resources to suppress her name. Yet almost everyone affected by her informing already knows the identity of Lawyer X. That's what Gobbo herself thinks, anyway. In 2016, she will testify that the whole world knew what she had done after the story was published. When I say the whole world, I probably should clarify that to anyone who would have a reason to harm me, because the people, a lot of people in prison, the Herald Sun is their Bible. She loses every remaining friend from the legal fraternity. She isn't even able to attend her own home auction in Bayside, Melbourne, for security reasons. On the 12th floor of the Herald Sun's South Bank office, Johnston and Dowsley have bunkered down for a long fight. They have an early win. Within 3 days of Dowsley's first story, the awkwardly named Independent Broad-Based Anti-Corruption Commission, IBAC, the successor to Nixon and Overland's Office of Police Integrity, OPI, announces that it will investigate the Lawyer X claims. An inquiry into police management of an informer recently identified in the Herald Sun as Lawyer X will be headed by a retired Victorian Supreme Court judge, Murray Kellam QC. So much for the police source in an Age newspaper story who mocked the Herald Sun's Watergate story as more like Fountain Gate, a suburban shopping centre. Victoria Police set up their own review into Gobbo's use 10 days after the Herald Sun's first story. Operation Bendigo is tasked with assessing the potential legal conflicts arising from Gobbo's intelligence. Bendigo is directly triggered by Dowsley's stories. Its establishment goes to the power of the press. Police have sat on Comrie's review for almost 2 years and done little to explore the implications of its findings. Within Victoria Police, Operation Bendigo is described as a response to extremely serious threats made to Gobbo as a result of increased media reporting. It will identify 5 possible legal conflicts relating to a sting involving a Mockbell henchman and his associates. The Herald Sun, along with all media outlets, will be kept ignorant of Operation Bendigo until court-released documents reveal its existence in December 2018. A month or so after the initial story breaks, Dowsley meets Gobbo at a South Melbourne wine bar. She's in mother mode, fumbling with her toddler. She has put off previous scheduled catch-ups, citing clashes with her daughter's doses of Peppa Pig. Gobbo is quietly dressed, no drawing of attention to herself. The short skirts and low-cut tops belong to an earlier life. The master spy is now a dedicated mum. As Gobbo's little girl plays with the beads around her mother's neck, Dowsley sips a white wine. Gobbo is pleasant, easy to talk to, even if she appears more eager to receive information than provide it. Afterwards, though, he will be struck by a pattern to the chat. Gobbo switches to the default setting she's used with killers who've asked similar questions over the years. She deflects them. She always responds to a line of inquiry by offering details on an unrelated subject. She is complimentary of Dowsley's first story. "You'll win a Walkley for it," she says. "Not if it's not true," Dowsley replies. He tries to ask questions about her informing. She listens to his insights as if mentally building a dossier of what he knows and what he doesn't. But she neither confirms nor denies them. Instead, she asks questions of her own, probably because she is planning another civil claim against Victoria Police. She knows lots of police, obviously, but denies knowing the officers whom Darsley names as her handlers. Instead, she focuses on her contempt for others in the force, such as the drunk detective she assisted as he stumbled home in Bali, when he was meant to be protecting her. Darsley asks her about Rob Karam and the tomato tins case. He knows she handed the crucial bill of lading to police. "Rob is my friend," Gobbo counters. "I spoke to him only yesterday." Darsley again asks her if she was a police informer. She again avoids answering. He asks her about her threat to jump from a roof in 2009. She denies it. Over 2 hours, Gobbo conceals the chaos set off by Darsley's newspaper story. Offstage, police bemoan Gobbo's recalcitrance, while she shrieks about their breaching of her trust. Victoria Police and Nicola Gobbo seethe with mutual resentment, like a broken couple post-divorce. Darsley, meanwhile, is being courted by stakeholders masquerading as his new best friends forever. Mick Gatto is the first to call him on the morning of his exclusive story. He wants to talk about Farouk Orman. Gatto later feeds Darsley pasta at his Carlton restaurant. Detective Sergeant Steve Mansell, who has now left the force, has a coffee with Darsley. He and Detective Senior Constable Paul Rowe were the two Piranha detectives who first invited Gobbo to become an informer in September 2005, leading to her registration as 3838. He tells Darsley that Gobbo wanted to inform after "we put it on her," that is, compelled her to be registered as an informer. Lawyers, too, are avid readers of Darsley's stories. Robert Richter QC is intrigued. His client Farouk Orman was convicted in strange circumstances in 2009. He, like many in the legal circles, knows that Lawyer X is Gobbo. She acted strangely, Richter recalls, after their client Orman was arrested for murder in 2007. Darsley visits Zara Guard Wilson, who begins chatting about her old colleague and foe. She tells Darsley about a kid arrested in a Mockbell drug house in 2006. Criminal solicitors, like doctors, receive calls at all times of the day and night. This tale began with a panicked phone call to Guard Wilson in the small hours. "Come now, right now, it's an emergency." Guard Wilson's caller was an 18-year-old man, though he sounded even younger. He hadn't done much, except be in the wrong place at the wrong time. His best legal response to police questioning, according to Guard Wilson, say nothing. She turned up at the St Kilda Road police complex as quickly as she could, and waited. This was how it worked. It might be an hour, perhaps three, before detectives allowed her to see her client. This time, however, the ritual was interrupted. Gobbo materialized, all huff and bustle, to be ushered through by a familiar detective. His name would later turn up in confidential police documents. Detective Senior Constable Jason Kelly of Task Force Piranha knew Gobbo well. A text message from Gobbo beeped on Guard Wilson's phone. She was being dismissed. "All sorted. You can go home." Yet Guard Wilson did not go home. She was finally allowed to speak to the young man. He was shaking. He was friends with the daughter of one of the traffickers. He had never been in trouble before. The young man told Guard Wilson that Gobbo had advised him to say he was there to cut up drugs. He should tell police everything to improve his chances of bail. "It was very poor legal advice," Guard Wilson tells Darsley. He would be implicating himself in crimes for which there was no other evidence. A confession would also expose him to reprisals from Mockbell Associates. He was entitled to bail whether he spoke to police or not, Guard Wilson says, given they had nothing on him. Yet the young man made a statement to say he was helping to package drugs, pleaded guilty, and received a community corrections order. His talking must have helped the police. Gobbo, his barrister, was not working for him at all, but for the officers who wanted to charge him. Guard Wilson thinks she was glimpsing the bigger Gobbo picture by then. She saw herself as a thorn in the side of police at the time, because she expressed her concerns about Gobbo's strange behaviour. This happened 8 years before Dalsley went to the Palmerston for drinks, then published the truth in the Herald Sun. Joe Aquaro, the honoured society lawyer who represented most of the Tomato Tins drug cartel, wants to discuss with Dalsley how dangerous people have spread misinformation about him. Among these nasty rumours are suggestions that he was Lawyer X. Dalsley had rung Aquaro in August 2015 to talk about other things, the mafia's supposed tentacles in politics, as well as a purported contract on Aquaro's life. Dalsley doesn't know at this stage that Aquaro has deep links with Gobbo, or that Aquaro himself will later be accused of being a police informer. Details of such accusations remain clouded to this day. 3 years earlier, bullets were sent in the mail to Aquaro's parents. Perhaps it was then that he began talking to police. He was close to Gobbo during the peak period of her informing. Those convicted of the Tomato Tins importation have questioned both Gobbo's and Aquaro's roles as lawyers and informers. Aquaro, to Dalsley's surprise, is candid when they meet. He is beset by myriad problems. When he was 17, Aquaro was anointed as a rising star by the head of Melbourne's honoured society, Laborio Benvenuto. He has always liked to be known as the society's consigliere, the advisor and networker. He puts people together, as he did a decade ago, when he brought Gobbo to a lunch and Frank Madaffri thought she was just another of Aquaro's blondes. He gained mafia respect when he helped overturn a deportation order against Frank Madaffri, a decision that would politically haunt then-immigration minister Amanda Vanstone. But now, Aquaro has been jettisoned from the cocoon. He has been accused of breaking the 'Drangheta's golden rule of omerta, the code of silence. He has not only lost his place within the honoured society, but he's also lost his sense of identity. Aquaro has fought battles over legal fees, his ice cream restaurant Jello Bar, his three sons and a partner. Long-time friends the Madaffris have fallen out with him over his alleged 'Drangheta betrayal. Frank Madaffri turned up at Jello Bar in 2013. A punch-up erupted and Madaffri was left bleeding. Aquaro borrowed from the Sopranos to smear Madaffri's blood on his face and declare, "Now we will die together." Aquaro has forgotten about Omerta. He swells with pride and reeks of loneliness. He has had to move his office down the hallway and up a small flight of stairs, away from his old firm, which still advises the mafia identities he now fears. The room is dim and strewn with papers, like an afterthought or a place to hide. Aquaro speaks softly over scotches, clinking Dalsley's tumbler with a salute. He wants to write his memoirs. Violence clings to him. He speaks of a gun he once stashed in his roof. Threatening to share his mafia links is a fast track to the kind of beating inflicted upon him in 2002. After Aquaro's mate fumbled for a pen gun in the basement of a Carlton pizza restaurant, Aquaro will meet Dalsley again and again in person. He's in touch with a police officer at Piranha, and with his psychic, Sarah Culkins. One night in early March 2016, Aquaro calls the detective repeatedly, perhaps about an upcoming case. The following week, he calls Culkins four times over 4 hours on her 1-800 line. Black magic has deep roots within the mafia. Major gangland figures are known to seek spiritual assistance. As Aquaro speaks to Culkins, his killer lurks outside Jello Bar on Lygon Street. No one could be certain of the reasons for Aquaro's end. He has just closed his restaurant when he is shot repeatedly in the chest. His body is found in the street in the early hours of the 15th of March 2016 by a garbage man. 70-year-old labourer Vincenzo Cruppi will stand trial in 2020, suspected of killing Acquaro over a small debt for tiling work at Jello Bar. Cruppi and Acquaro fought at the restaurant in the weeks before Acquaro's death, and Cruppi is suspected of having started a fire at the premises in January 2016. Acquaro dies the way of so many victims who fall out with the underworld, paranoid and alone. Gobbo has risked a similar fate for more than a decade.